You are listening to Waiting on Reparations, a production of iHeartRadio. Somebody help me, I'm depressed because when daddy gets a charter plane and sends us all away to holiday in an exotic place, I always end up blowing lines as any cat a molecade and planet ended all with razor blades. I'm probably not okay. Revolution carne, sitting up at our estate, not far away from where the Hiltons live. Beverly Hills and Villa Crest, blister them because my will to live is minimal. Shouldn't go to 26 years old, isn't it pitiful? But is this truly the cruelest world, or if you did it right, could it truly be something beautiful?
I don't have nothing this week. Yo, I just wanna spit dope, make you feel shit. Walking in my big black boots, that's a steel tip. Was a wooden puppet, I just wanna be a real kid. Or whatever, as long as I avoid being a neolib like Neo did. I'll be moving faster than you see. You don't know if it's computers or I'm mastering my chi. Keep guessing, I'll be sweating like the pastor when he preach. And got him paying attention like his class and I'ma teach. Now you kids gon' pass or I'll whip your ass. And all my white friends sad cause the crypto crash. All right, I'm done. Hey, what's going on, y'all?
What's good, people?
I'm Dope Knife.
I'm Lingua Franca.
We are waiting on reparations.
Man, hurry that shit up.
So what's good with you?
Yo, nothing. Nothing.
I mean, no,
good.
I heard that there's some wild shit going up in Athens.
Yeah, yeah, so I think I've spoken in recent episodes about the uptick in gun violence. He had a recent shooting. I may have referenced that the suspect was 15 years old, suspected to have killed a 38-year-old man with an AR-15. I'm getting calls like every day from people who, like mothers whose houses got shot up, and them and their 7 kids are now homeless as they're seeking to move somewhere safer.
Damn.
And then Sunday, I was informed that there was an attempted robbery at a local pool, a splash pad, like aquatic recreational facility, about a 10-minute walk from my house, where a guy showed up with a rifle and tried to steal the cash box, and then upon leaving, carjacked someone at gunpoint, and then when the police arrived, they shot him. They shot him to death, and so that is like. That all transpired in the park where I walk every day.
Oh, shit.
On Sunday. And so, I've been speaking with people who work in the, like, with the homeless community, also very near my house. They believe this man may have been a part of that community.
So they don't know who it was yet?
His name has been released, but in the like a homeless community, like he went by like a moniker. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to confirm that this was the person they think it was, because they hadn't seen this guy around.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't around yesterday. They're wondering like, where is he? And so, I kind of issued a statement about the situation. There's two ways to answer the question. Did this have to happen? And if you look at the facts of the immediate context, that he was armed with a rifle, that he, you know, assaulted several people, and had a standoff with the police, the short answer would be yes. If you look at the fact that he may have been homeless, and, you know, look at all of the things in his life that led him to that point, that he's gonna rob the cash box from a children's pool,
yeah,
and steal a car. Like, you know, you're not living your best life if you got to that point. And that everything, every support he may have had or lacked, is a matter of public policy. Like, you know, and any opportunity he may have had or lacked, any stability he may have had or lacked, are all choices that governments make.
And I imagine it's going to be pretty hard for them to put together exactly what went wrong.
And that's really a broader policy prescription that I've argued previously for, and I feel like I'm righteous from this scenario as well, is that we do not have a comprehensive system of reporting on collecting information about the folks that end up in our jails or end up interacting in the criminal justice system about the life circumstances that brought them to the point of criminal activity. And imagine what we could do with that information. If we had a quantifiable, if we had a database of interviews with every person that ends up getting picked up by the cops and is sitting in jail, and say, we have a remarkable pattern of people that dropped out of high school, or of people that had substance abuse issues, or people that were homeless. Like, and could, like, use that data to say, maybe we should invest in housing so
you
that
can stop it before it even gets to that point.
Yeah, you stop it before it even gets to that point. And so I've just had that really, it's been weighing on me a lot. It brings us to the topic of this episode, this interview that I did a few weeks ago with my friend and journalist and writer, pal, Matt Pulver. We talk about neoliberalism and the fact that every other part of the social safety net under neoliberalism gets the axe. Housing gets the axe, you know, various benefit programs.
Pretty much the whole safety net is like expendable.
The whole safety net is up for grabs, up for privatization, security forces. You know, that's the last standing, I guess, social safety net, if you can even call it that.
They've been chipping away at the safety net for so long, though. Does it even necessarily qualify as a safety net anymore?
It's a fucking tightrope.
Yeah, it's like it's not just
a safety net. It's the tightrope
it's like
that we have to walk.
Strung together, like bandages.
right. Yeah, and so I you know, everyone thinks I'm a cop hater and stuff, and that might be accurate sometimes. But in this particular scenario, going back to the scenario of this dude, I feel terrible for the police officer that had to shoot this man. Mm-hmm. Our unraveling of a social safety net put him in the position where he had to kill someone. Like, no, but I don't want that for anybody. I don't doubt they want that for themselves. And so in this episode, we kind of talk about the what neoliberalism is, how we see it manifest, particularly in Atlanta and in Atlanta hip hop. And so I'm just also reflecting the last couple days on how we're seeing it here in Athens, how we see it everywhere. And how it directly impacts, you know, we think very systemically about, you know, these systems of power and like capital, et cetera, but like the way it impacted one man's life that ended on Sunday.
Yeah.
Cause he was so desperate. He stole $40 out of a cash box at a children's playground.
Yeah. And it's like, nobody really is going to ever get to know like what his full story was.
No one will ever know his full story. I doubt. That, you know, GBI will do an investigation, determined the Georgia Bureau of Investigation will do an investigation, determine the shooting was justified, but close the book on it and walk away. Because context, like the idea of like, oh, well, the context in which this thing happened is so limited to like the immediate context in which it happened, and loses all of the full context that actually explains both why it happened and how it could be prevented. Yeah. So,
well, ladies and gentlemen, we're going to be back with that interview with Matt Pulver right after the jump.
So we are here with Matt Pulver, a writer that is based here in Athens, Georgia. So Matt, thanks for joining us. Tell us a little bit about who you are.
Hi, I'm Matt Pulver. I'm a writer and researcher here in Athens, Georgia.
I'm happy to have you on here. I've loved a lot of the work that you've done, both on, you know, local pieces of history, but then particularly this piece you wrote in 2016, I believe, Empire State of the South, which talks a little bit about neoliberalism, talks a lot about neoliberalism and the ways that it's impacted Atlanta hip hop. And so usually on the show, we look at specific pieces of policy, housing policy, policing, labor. But this week, we're going to be looking at sort of a bundle of policy choices made under the common framework of neoliberalism and how we've seen that impact Atlanta and then consequently Atlanta and hip hop. But to start out, to make sure we and our listeners are beginning from a similar foundation, let's talk about what neoliberalism is before discussing some of its manifestations in the city of Atlanta. So how would you define neoliberalism?
Yeah, I mean, I'm okay. So neoliberalism, what neoliberalism isn't for me is new liberalism, like liberal, like the way in the States we talk about, you know, the Democrats are liberals, and the neoliberal would be just like a new liberal.
Right. The way to segment the words, you would just be like, oh, sure. Like if you are new and you are to the left, da da da. It's actually more specific than that.
Confusingly, it's a conservative raft of policies. I mean, it's basically, you know, it's hyper capitalism. You know, it's liberalism in the old school sense, the more sort of European sense of the word, where, you know, the liberalization of markets, making basically the extension of capitalist logic to virtually anything and everything. So typically how I think about it, you know, in the last 30 years, you can think of it as maybe like, you know, Reaganomics or Thatcherism, that then gets adopted by liberals, so-called, you know, the Clintonite sort of Democratic Party. But it begins, I mean, it's a conservative project. It's, you know, it's the encroaching or the sort of the devouring of the nation state and the functions of the nation state by capital. So, you know, what does that mean? It means like, you know, privatizing infrastructure, you know, water, privatizing education, public housing. It's the, you know, ultimately what it is sort of the erasure, or at least the diminution of national sovereignty at the behest of you know, globalized capital. You know, after neoliberalism, I mean, you know, so what it you know, it does two things. You know, sort of inside the country, what it does is it's welfare reform under Clinton. It's attempts to privatize education, privatize infrastructure, privatize prisons, privatize the military. All these big, huge federal outlays that investors look at, all the, you know, the world over, look at and just, you know, lick their chops. They, you know, there's so much money to be made if you made every student a customer, basically. So you do that sort of internally. And then externally, sort of on the global scale, you now have multinational, you know, or even sort of post-national sort of corporate entities and banks and flows of capital that override national sovereignty. You know, so then you have things like the NAFTA zone, and then you had, you know, the Trans-Pacific Partnership that was, you know, scuttled, but, you know, will probably come back in some form. But yeah, put simply, it's the shrinking of government, and the sort of the ultimate devouring of government and its actions by capital. It's hyper-capitalism, to put it in a sort of a word.
Got you. And so,
if that makes any sense.
Yeah, totally. And in the piece, you talk a little bit about how, for example, with like free enterprise zones, which Clintonite Democrats termed empowerment zones to kind of give it more bipartisan buy-in, it sometimes has the sheen of like, oh, expanding liberties, giving people more options, lifting people up by like giving more people access to markets, but really it seems like it's giving markets more control over human lives than like ensuring, you know, ensuring rights through power, like strong forms of government.
Right, because I mean, you know, capital is not beholden to, you know, say what you want about the state of, you know, American democracy and the ability to alter its course, you know, citizens, there's still an avenue for that. Capital doesn't have to give two shits about you, and doesn't, you know, so it's an entirely different arrangement. When you invite capital in to be, more and more the sort of sole arbiter of people's fates, that's an, you know, where they have no say whatsoever, you know, in the end.
Yeah. So in your piece, you say that, neoliberal globalization doesn't make the many nations into one, but each into many, which I found really interesting because by the definition you just gave, it sounds like, oh, you know, it's with like NAFTA or like TPP, like globalization, it's like, you know, erasing borders, making us all citizens of this one global like community. So can you talk us a little bit about this idea of actually the way that neoliberal globalization sort of creates more borders and because further fragments and segments society in certain ways?
Yeah. I mean, I think this is, I feel like this is an under-studied, under-analyzed component of neoliberal globalization. Because, yeah, I mean, I think we have this sort of, you know, John Lennon utopia sort of in our minds.
Imagine all the people and we're all holding hands.
Yeah, right. And it does do that. I mean, it does connect, you know, it does connect London to New York to Rio to Beijing. There are nodes of capital that do exist in a large sort of global apparatus or a network. You know, that is real. And it does erase the power of borders in a lot of ways, especially for capital, not for people. Ask anybody on the southern border of this country. But you might think of it as sort of replacing or moving those sort of erstwhile national borders into the nation state itself. So it starts to bisect and segment nation states that used to be more whole or unitary, while simultaneously connecting nodes of capital power, metropolises, you know, and the various sort of capital flows and supply chains. You know, there is this connecting of the world, but then also this simultaneous dividing of you know, cities and cities from rural areas. You know, there's a, oh God, I forget his name, but there's a British thinker or writer who has this conception of the anywheres and the somewheres. The anywheres are sort of the cosmopolitans who, you know, might live in or near a big metropolis in the States or anywhere across the world. And they are, in a way, more connected to each other than they are to their sort of countrymen, for lack of a better way of saying it, fellow citizens. And I think that's how I would partially diagnose the political crisis here in the States and in Britain, Brexit, India, you know, all over the world. These, you know, these anywheres, these sort of people who are, you know, engaged in, you know, in the knowledge economy and can sort of could easily plug themselves into London or Beijing or mm-hmm. Lahore or someplace, and the somewheres who are still rooted in place. Mm-hmm. And anyway, and so in Atlanta, we see a especially during the 90s, we see a heightened a manifestation of this, where you see these borders that are increasingly determinative, you know, of someone's fates or of people's fates inside the old nation state. If that makes any sense.
Yeah, let's get into specifically how we see this manifest physically in like the geography of Atlanta, perhaps starting off with thinking around like housing policy. So in the piece, you speak a little bit about back when they were prepping for the 1996 Olympic Games, they needed to make the city look nice for all this influx of people that were coming, and what mm-hmm. some of the impacts were on what that then meant for the way the city got redeveloped during that time.
Yeah, I mean, Atlanta provides a really interesting way to look at, you know, the 20th century, where you have in 1935, FDR comes to Atlanta to commemorate Techwood Homes right there in the middle of Atlanta as the first public housing for Atlantans, white Americans at the time. And then in 94-95, Techwood Homes becomes the first public housing project demolished by the city of Atlanta, on their way to demolishing all public housing stock in the city of Atlanta. Atlanta becomes the first major American city to demolish all housing to pursue to replace it with what they called a diversified real estate company, the head of the Atlanta Housing Authority talked about connecting the projects with, quote, the world of modern real estate capital and finance, privatizing the thing, basically, or semi-privatizing.
Right. It goes back to that idea of, like, with, like, empowerment zones, like, oh, we're modernizing, you know, city of Atlanta. It sounds so, like grand and, like, uplifting in a certain sense, but it's, like, who is it lifting? Ultimately, lifting capital. Yeah. It's not really, like, looking at the people that are living in these homes, et cetera.
Yeah, I mean, it's a pretty story that they can tell. But I mean, if you look at where, you know, Techwood Homes used to be, it was right smack dab there next to Georgia Tech, right where Centennial Park is, right up against the edge of it. That was just fantastically valuable real estate that was right in the middle of their little Olympic stuff they wanted to do. It was also, you know, it's where poor folks lived, and they didn't. They wanted to, you know, get the city all gussied up for their little twirl on the international stage. So it served these, you know, these multiple purposes. We get rid of those that blight of the poor people who have been left behind by the city, and also clear the way for capital. Also turns each of those public housing residents into, you know, they either get a voucher or just have to make it on their own, and it turns into profit bearing customers now. And listen, no one's saying that the 20th century public housing model was perfect. There were certainly things that probably, you know, that needed to be done, but it's best to think of it as like urban renewal. There's no less trauma in demolishing every single home of people in public housing in Atlanta. That's no less traumatic than what happened in the you know, 40s, 50s, 60s during urban renewal. It was actually on perhaps even on a larger scale.
Yeah, I mean, you can say what you want about public housing and, like, its quality and what having these, like, condensed pockets of poverty then mean for the quality of life people living there with regards to crime, et cetera, qualities of schools. But, like, displacing those folks en masse is certainly going to be traumatic no matter how well they're living where they are, for sure.
Well, yeah, I mean, because it's not done. The residents are not the ones with agency. I mean, you know, it's one thing if, you know, it's done from above, just like urban renewal was. Mm-hmm. You know, the urban renewal that built a lot of those projects returned again and said, you know, like, you know, oh, we need this land over here. So here, we're going to put you all over. We're going to take your houses, knock them down, burn them down, put you in this public housing over here. 50 years later, oh, no, we need that land over there. We need that public housing land. Sorry about that. We're going to push you out, you know, and now give you Section 8 vouchers or whatever. And good fucking luck. Like, they didn't track anybody. They, you know, for years, I talked to some researcher at Georgia State back when I was writing this, and, you know, and asked, does anybody know where those people ended up? No, because that wasn't even an afterthought. They don't care. They mm-hmm. needed the land, and they needed those folks out of the way, and so they did it.
Yeah.
You know, period. That's what happened.
So how do we see the impacts of particularly neoliberal housing policy manifest, like, in hip hop music from Atlanta, as particularly in the piece you speak about a number of music videos that, like, in the visuals that are presented, kind of tell the story of a lot of the impacts of policies such as these?
Yeah, I mean, you know, you'll see it in visuals where you have, you know, because when you, what you end up with are these little, you know, smaller and smaller sort of pockets of, you know, especially as the sort of the wealthy infill has happened in cities like Atlanta, where everybody's come back in, the upwardly mobile, you know, folks have come back in and thrown their weight around. You have these, you know, smaller and smaller pockets of intense wealth and intense poverty, and they're sort of, you know, very close to each other. It's very a sort of a chaotic patchwork of, you know, of yeah, and you see it also in places like Detroit. I think Danny Brown, Detroit rapper, has rapped about this. He has a song called like Field House, I think, and it's like field, field, house, 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 field.
Field, 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 house. Abandoned house, field, field. That nigga must sicker.
Like where, you know, where there's fields where there used to be houses, and it's just this it's this sort of micro rearrangement of the geography. When it's not macro, but like, you know, it's strange. There, you know, there are walls in between, like, you know, really, really upscale condos and like Edgewood, and then like Section 8 housing separated by this like big, you know, border wall sort of thing with cameras and, you know, spikes or whatever. And then you have rappers who grew up, you know, in the projects, and those were their homes.
Yeah.
And, you know, so there was a rapper Pill, or there is a rapper Pill, not as big as he was a few years ago. He was with Killer Mike for a little while and I think Maybach Music. And, you know, he talks a lot about that. You know, I mean, he speaks on that utter powerlessness.
We hustling, people struggle, you ain't made it. So it's back out to the streets and I'm calling them home. Make sure I black out all the people preaching, calling my phone.
Of calling a place home, but you know, and not the best home in the world, but it was your home. You live your life. You know, I mean, and just have that taken from you in en masse. You know, with no argument or agency on your part. So yeah, Pill is a rapper. We talked a lot about that. There've been some others. You know, and you know, it could be argued, and I can't. It could be argued that, you know, the stuff you see by the end of the 90s, early 2000s in Atlanta hip hop, sort of reflects this darker mood. You know, like by the time you get to like Outkast, Stankonia, it's got a darker, more political vibe. Killer Mike drops his first album somewhere in the early, those first years of the 2000s. Goody Mob was, you know, speaking on some of this stuff during the 90s. But if things get, there's this weird paradox, right, where you have, you know, in thinking more broadly, to zoom back out from Atlanta, during the 90s, when Atlanta is experimenting with this hyper-capitalism, more broadly, you have this sort of capitalist triumphalism, right? 89, 90, that's the end of the Cold War. Communism has been vanquished. And so in the political elite, you have this, I mean, they're fucking giddy. It's this triumphalism, this imperial and capitalistic triumphalist spirit. It's the end of history, right? Says Fukuyama. But on society's edges, let's say, you, and certainly in youth culture, across the board, you find that is not shared at all. There's a sort of a darkness that is, I would argue, recognized by youth culture broadly, hip hop for sure. That's saying, you know, hey, things aren't so sweet, right? I mean, like Clinton is prancing about, you know, the Dow is going through the roof, and you know, the stock market is incredible. But you know, folks like Killer Mike and Dead Prez and all these people that are coming around in the end of the 90s, early 2000s are saying, nah, shit ain't sweet like that. Like, and I think in Atlanta, you see that, you see a real pronounced case of this sort of disconnect between the elite spirit of triumphalism and capitalism will solve everything. Markets will solve everything. Every social ill, and folks on the bottom or on the edges, however you want to say it, are providing a counter narrative to that.
I was thinking about a little bit about what the relationship is between, because we talked a little bit about like the way it impacts geographies, and then the piece you talk about the way that then geographies in Atlanta kind of get split up in Atlanta hip hop get split up into these police zones, which is actually something I'm familiar with through like the uprising last summer and like organizing around like where different protests were going to be. Like people talk about, yo, we're going to be in zone one, we're going to be in zone three. Like these like the police state sort of like delineating these neighborhoods in a way that actual community, a sense of community cohesion or continuity of like landscape with regards to like actual physical neighborhoods and people living to get there together do. And so I wondered if you could speak some to the relationship between neoliberalism and like the rise in policing in Atlanta.
That's a good question. Yeah, I mean, the only part of the state that really survives intact when neoliberalism makes its way in is police power, is the monopoly on violence. And yeah, I mean, we all know, I mean, if you've grown up listening to Atlanta hip hop, I mean, you know, which rappers are from which police zone. And so it's kind of a natural thing. It's like Gucci is from zone six, but what a dystopian fucking geography. Like, yeah. You know, not like, you know, you're not from, you know, in New York, you're from Spanish Harlem, you're from Bed-Stuy, you're from, you know, at least it's got a name. It's drawn by the power of the police and the jurisdiction of the police, which is just so fitting in the first, you know, American neoliberal city, that would be how geography comes to be marked by police zone. You know, free enterprise zones. No rapper ever, you know, shouted out free enterprise zone. But that's another, you know, these strange zones where, you know, it's all about the presence or absence of governmental power in the various ways that it can manifest, whether through, you know, regulation and taxation or the means of violence or coercion. You know, it's extremely neoliberal to me.
And so I guess what I hear you saying, what I hear from like when as now thinking about the music through this lens, it's like you might hear people talk about the underinvestment in their communities around areas like housing or education or the struggles to get a job because, you know, capital's flowing into the hands of elite corporations and not necessarily being channeled from the government into communities that need uplift. But the only thing that gets left that like the government is funding is the police. And so you fuck the police. You got people out here, you got like Rich Homie Quan in his music video, you referenced in the piece, tussling with the cops. Cause that's the last interaction. That's the left between government and the people that people even have under this like policy paradigm.
Yeah, right. I mean, you end welfare, you start tearing down people's homes, and so people are in more and more precarious states. So, you know, so the feeling by, you know, governmental leaders and the elite is that we need more cops, more cells, more prisons, more, you know, there's never a hesitation to drop money on that. But, you know, housing, you know, and the rest of it, is neglected. It's sort of that's the last sort of, you know, residue of the state, you know, under increasing neoliberalism. Sub Comandante Marcos, the Zapatista spokesman.
Yeah, I didn't know about this until I read your piece, and I was like, "Yo, that's crazy! That's super cool."
Yeah.
Talk some about like their reaction to some neoliberal policies. I guess was it the early '90s?
Yeah, 94. So they, Yeah, so they kick off their rebellion against the Mexican state in, on January 1st, 94, the day that NAFTA went into effect. And Subcomandante Marcos was sort of the spokesman for the group and ended up sort of becoming the for a while there, the sort of the premier voice on neoliberalism. And as he hypothesizes, it doesn't unite the world into one big shiny happy place, but starts placing borders inside the erstwhile nation states, and leaves only the sort of the residual power of the police and I guess the military, but certainly the police, the sort of the internal armed apparatus of the state. Marcos is helpful, to think through, what happened in the 90s and shit was happening now, but, he has some really good insights on sort of what happened in that really crucial moment of the 90s when basically the entire world becomes, for the first time in human history, the entire world becomes a fully capitalist space. I can't say enough about Marcos.
Yeah, and I feel like I hear echoes in that, like they were rising up in their own way. And then you've got like Killer Mike, who in Reagan and other songs kind of talked about like rebelling against the state, like being surveilled, being under this constant surveillance, and having to like kind of fight back, like, who's that peeping in my window? Stay strapped, etc. Perhaps not through as like crystallized a view, or like as with that like sort of that the clarity of framework of like how all these things have come together to create the situation, but still the same sort of like ethos of like, nah, man, this ain't right, and like I'm gonna fight back. Y'all ain't about to take me alive.
That surveillance piece too, right? Like. Goody Mob has, cell therapy from sometime in the mid to late 90s. Then Mike sort of interpolates that. And then you also have in Atlanta, you have these sort of public-private partnerships or just the entrance of capital into policing where, they're just this proliferation of cameras everywhere. Private, but then they're sort of commandeered by the cops through various, arrangements where, the cops can, and I'm not sure exactly how it happens, but they can get in on the back end of private security.
Right, there's like private sector cameras that the police have access to.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's this way of like privatization, but as long as the police still have controls and like,
right.
Are well funded to like take advantage of the ways that capital marginalizes effectively.
And like I was saying earlier, where you have that sort of weird paradox of that triumphalism among the elite and then in anger and desperation at the edges, you see, whether it's Killer Mike or Immortal Technique, Dead Prez, Most Def, all these folks, the Roots, their album, that comes out in what, maybe 2000, 1999, something like that. Things Fall Apart. There's just a darker tone that starts to emerge, or a revolution in the, and with folks like Dead Prez and Immortal Technique and people like that. I mean, a revolutionary, a revolutionary stance. I mean, Dead Prez were, and are socialist black nationalists, who provided just, such a counter narrative to, that Clintonite, Reaganite, again, triumphalism, that glorious victory that the American empire had achieved.
Yeah. In wrapping up, I had one last question. So we kind of talked about the way neoliberalism manifests in housing policy with the displacement of communities in public housing. We talked a little bit about the way it feeds into economic development with empowerment zones. We talked about the way it sort of, how the police state ends up being the only thing left of the state as all these things get privatized. I wanted to talk a little bit about the privatization, the attempted privatization of water in Atlanta. Because this is actually something that Mos Def touches upon somewhat in New World Water off of
Both
Sides. Mm-hmm. So talk to us a little bit about that. And then, I might like bring up the song, Mos Def song, and like kind of relate it to that.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it's not as sexy maybe as, you know, the privatization of police or the military or whatever. But, you know, at the time when Mayor Campbell privatizes Atlanta's water, it was the largest public infrastructure privatization in U.S. history. It still might be. I'm not sure. But I mean, it was, you know, that was one of those last frontiers for global capital. So, you know, this multinational meta-national conglomerate, Suez, buys this hefty chunk of Atlanta infrastructure, the provision of water. At the same time that another big multinational conglomerate had done the same in Bolivia. Now, in Bolivia, it ends up sparking an uprising in Cochabamba, which then eventually gives us Evo Morales, who was the leader in that rebellion. He was a coca farmer union leader, and then becomes, of course, the president, very popular president of Bolivia for years after that. But in Atlanta, it's quieter. It goes off without a hitch for a while until it hits the fan. Because corporations don't have any business messing with our water, and it showed, and that thing. I mean, it was only a few years, and that plan went belly up, and Atlanta had to figure out a new way to do it. But like I said, it's not the sort of sexiest. It's not of neoliberalism's conquest, but you got to think, like, these are these huge apparatuses, you know, at the city, state, federal level that corporations look at and they're thinking, why is this publicly owned, you know, when we could be making money for investors and shareholders.
Well, I actually think like the privatization of something as basic as water is like sexier, perhaps even than when we talk about privatization of housing or channeling government funds into projects in the private sector around economic development, because water is so basic. Like, we could argue, like, I don't want to have to argue, but I will argue someone over whether housing is a human right, whether the government has a duty to economically empower people. But, like, you literally can't argue that, like, everyone, like, you need water. Like, you can be without everything else in your life. If you don't have water, you cannot live. And so, like, the fact that it's so basic actually makes it more insidious and more interesting, potentially, than, like, squabbling over, like, well, should public housing, you know, should public housing even exist? It's a conversation I don't want to have, but do have to have, oftentimes in policymaking.
Right. Yeah, no, that's a good point. Like in Bolivia, there was they would say that, I forget the big corporation that bought Bolivia's water, but somehow per the agreement or the contract, they owned, the Bolivians would say that this company owned the rain, which is a really fucking dystopian way of thinking about things, because apparently, like, any rain that would fall into cisterns or something that would be collected was property, was a commodity owned by some multinational faceless corporation. To own the rain is fucking dark. So yeah, you're right. I mean, it's at the basis of human life, and for it to be commodified. And again, in the case of Bolivia, they they buy the rain and then dramatically hike the prices. I want to say like they tripled the price of water or something for, you know, for some desperately poor people. I mean, that's how you get a revolution real quick.
Bolivia. Get a revolution real quick. And that's why it's perhaps more like scintillating than like, oh, sure. If the government's not providing housing, like we're used to that.
Right.
Suddenly we don't got no water? Yeah, no. People about to be in the streets.
Yeah, right? Yeah, no, yeah, I think you're right. Yeah, yeah.
Word. Well, thank you for talking with me. Where can people keep up with your writing and other projects you're working on?
I'm not doing a ton of writing right now, but you can certainly check out my page on Medium. That's where you'd find this article that we were talking about and a handful of others. Matt Pulver on Medium would be the place to go.
All right, great.
So that was dope, yo. That was Matt Pulver. Where did he say that we could find him again? He said, check out his page on Medium.
He's got a Medium. Yeah, if you look, Matt Pulver Medium, he's on that shit. Yeah, I think he's like Matt Pulver on Twitter. He's got funny tweets. It's pretty low key.
Yeah, no, that whole conversation was bad funny.
No, he's a funny motherfucker. Yeah, yeah. And very smart, very smart. Educated me a lot about. People throw around the term neoliberalism a lot.
Yeah,
it's one of those. What do we really mean when we say that?
It's one of those like you can make fun of it by saying something neoliberal because people use it so much.
Right, but like really understanding like the transferences of capital and power that it entails and how it like all those things come together as like a uniform system.
And I'm all about, you know, definitions, you know, definitions of words and meanings of words. So that was useful for me. So now I won't misuse that shit.
Next week, we're going to be speaking about District Attorney Larry Krasner's reelection as District Attorney of Philadelphia. He was going up against the, police unions. And has been very progressive and kind of one of the leaders of the progressive prosecutor movement across the country. And so we're going to talk about what it means that he got reelected.
And we'll,
last week,
we'll also talk about hip hop's connection or relationship with various district attorneys as in real life and through Heard in Rhyme too. Hey, Joel, can you please drop a beat for us? Oh. Ooh. Yo, I float like a butterfly, sting like a bee. I don't rap like these other guys, I sing R&B. If you whack at some other lines, bring out a street. What you smoke is a fucking crime. See all the seeds on the streets, they know me. Call me the dope one. With Lingua Franca, we both roam like showguns. Defeat hordes on sheath swords and go dumb. Hi, y'all saving the world to smoke blunts. No dunce, put a knife in the shit. Room for my elbows, you know who cypher it is. Gums made of fire, like a venomous viper. I spit, married to this hip hop, get doing life for a bit. So I'm never waiting, and I'm looking for some reparations. Republicans are trying to put us back in segregation. This is just a taste, it's just a little demonstration. Why you hating?
I'm Lingua Franca.
I'm Dope Knife, and we are waiting on reparations.
Yes.
Damn, that was off as fuck. See?
Yes. Listen to Waiting on Reparations on the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.